Patrick Dineen is my guest here on the Dude Maker Hotline. His latest book is called Conserving America, Essays on Present Discontents, Dissident American Thought Today. I agree with everything you just said, all of it, especially the part about the local aspect here of it, because, you know, in modern America today, as I call it, we are taught to think big, big, big. Everything's got to be big. I want a big box store. I don't want to go to a little hardware store down the street. I want to go to Home Depot. And I want to go down to a little used car dealership down the street. I want to go to CarMax. Everything is big. We want bigger grocery stores. We want bigger department stores. Big, big, big. Amazon has big. It's got more books than anyone. I don't want to go to my little fuddy-duddy coffee shop / bookstore down the street. But every time, with this bigness, gigantism, is that a word, Patrick? Gigantism?
Yes, it is. Yes,
gigantism
it is.
That has infected the mind of the body politic and caused them to think that everything must be bigger. You got to have a bigger car, got to have a bigger house, got to have a bigger salary, got to have a bigger retirement fund, you name it. Everything that's secular is translated into bigness or into gigantism. Yet all the things that are really important are very small and local. Your family is the most important thing. The souls of those children that are under your roof. If you have children, as I do, I'm sure you and you do. Those little souls are the most important thing. Praying and working your way towards a holy death and a blessed eternity. That's the most important thing. Those are local. Those are small. You don't need big for that. You, as a matter of fact, I'd say, and I agree with you, that you need small. And we are seeing those. This is why I keep saying to friends, man, dudes and guys and gals, it's not that bad. I mean, it's bad. We'd like to convince ourselves we live in the worst of all times. There are signs out there. Look at 1 Peter 5. Who would have thought that Steve Skojic could actually make a go of that website? It's a good website, too. Look at the Catholic gentleman, Sam Guzman. Who would have thought that Sam could be so successful starting his own little blog, trying to encourage men to be men, leaders, and when I say men, Catholic Christian men or Christian Catholic men in your houses with your families. But Patrick, that's all small. That does not require gigantism, does it?
That's exactly right. Everything you just said was said with a particular, often unforgettable turns of phrase by the great G.K. Chesterton in many of his works. I'm sure you're familiar.
Yes.
Chesterton saw the great threat of the modern age exactly to be gigantism. That gigantism in both its market forms, what you're describing as the tendency in our markets for large, concentrated forms of economic power to become dominant, as well as in our political forms, the tendency for us to think that politics takes place in the big capital cities and that it's not sort of local democracy in the forms that Alexis de Tocqueville described, one of the hallmarks of the modern world is this kind of gigantism. And Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc and others of his time wrote that one of the great forms of resistance would be simply choices that people and communities would make to resist this kind of gigantism. One of the essays or chapters of the book that I'm particularly proud of, and I would commend to your readers, is one it's called Community and Freedom or Individualism and Statism. and what I'm really trying to argue in that chapter is that one of the real underlying forms of logic of the modern liberal order is to really centralize. And the way that centralization is advanced is by appealing to its capacity to liberate people, to make them into individuals, to give them the experience of no longer being bound by place or people or tradition or time. And so centralization and individualism aren't competitors. They aren't antagonists. They actually grow up together. And the ways to resist both of these things is to cherish and to foster our smaller places,
right,
and our communities and our families and our neighborhoods. And for too long, we've been drawn into, this is really kind of the central argument of my book, we've been drawn into the logic of the liberal frame. And as a result, we ourselves have been made into increasingly these liberal human beings that are shorn of these kinds of forms of more local, more particular kinds of identities. And as a result, can only see the state or can only see the centralizing market as the two forms in which we can sort of become expressive individualists.
844-527-8723, our telephone number. Patrick Deneen, the author of a new book out that you can get at Amazon, Conserving American Essays on Present Discontents, is on the Dudemaker hotline. And he just recommended a chapter in the book, Community and Freedom. What was the subtitle, Community and Freedom, or Statism and...
Individualism and statism.
Individualism and statism. That's a nice dissertation that you just gave. I look forward to actually reading that. And I was thinking you were talking about Chesterton. We have a Chesterton society here in Southeast Louisiana in Baton Rouge, and you would never know this, but unless you went here, if you went to the little tiny town, which is precisely 20 minutes from my home in Madisonville, Louisiana, to Ponchatoula, Louisiana, you get in the middle of downtown Ponchatoula, which is about a half mile long, right at the center of town where the train tracks are, which is used to be the center of many towns, is a building that was renovated about 5 years ago. Guess what it's called? Chesterton Square.
Great.
Guess what's standing out in front of Chesterton Square? A full-size bronze statue of G.K. himself. And on Saturday, March the 11th, David Simpson and I and others, our little radio channel here has bought a table for eight. The Chesterton Society annual meeting is going to be there, and I'm going to get to meet in person Joseph Pierce and others, academics like yourself who write and who teach Chesterton, and are going to come down, and I can't remember the theme, the Mystery at the Mud House, that's what it is, or Mud House Mystery. I guess that's one of his short stories. And they're going to give a talk. It's an all-day affair. I'm very much looking forward to it. But to me, and now it can only fit 50 people in this little in this Chesterton house. To me, that's something small and beautiful that I've never been in there. So I'm like excited, like my kids are excited to go to a concert to go see Elton. Who is it? Billy Joel in the Superdome. I'm more excited about Chesterton, about Joseph Pierce, than they are about Billy Joel.
Well, in a way, Chesterton was kind of the Billy Joel of his time.
Was he?
he was an extraordinarily popular author. Of course, right. Prolific, absolutely prolific author, and someone who wrote in so many different genres, and short stories and novels and, of course, essays and articles and poetry. He had an absolutely enormous following, and it's always a wonder to me and always great gratification for me that when I put a book of Chesterton in front of one of my students who I think is particularly receptive, it's like one of those experiences of watching the scales fall off from the eyes. The excitement of encountering something like his book Orthodoxy. Or even, one of my favorite Chesterton books is his first novel, which is called The Napoleon of Notting Hill, which is all about what we've been talking about. He portrays a character who lives in a part of London called Notting Hill.
Okay.
And the kind of elite authorities have decided to put a highway through the middle of it. and he rallies the residents of Notting Hill. They don medieval garb, and before you know it, the entire city of London has been turned into a medieval kind of a zone where people are defending their communities. And he sees this as a great sign of success that people are willing to now take up swords and halberds to defend places, neighborhoods like Notting Hill. So Chesterton saw a real logic of gigantism that was a threat to local communities, local loyalties, and the kinds of care and commitments that these kinds of places could foster.
Right.
One of the basic themes of this book that I wrote was that a liberal nation can't afford and ultimately can't sustain itself if it makes a liberal people. If, in other words, if it makes people who are formed in the vision of the liberal anthropology of that person in the state of nature,
okay,
only a rights-bearing human being without any commitments or obligations, without any deep sense of gratitude, without any sense of obligation to the future, someone who simply sees themselves as bearing rights and having every, freedom to do as one wishes, as long as one doesn't harm anyone else, that a liberal society that makes that kind of humanity ultimately can't sustain itself.
No.
And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of evidence from American society today that suggests that's exactly what has been happening.
Well, you know, Patrick, I just am just hearing you speak again. And folks, we are just blessed to be able to have academics and very well-versed and very prolific speakers like Patrick Dineen to be guests on our channel and our network, because I sit here making notes and learning as you're speaking. I'm like, I'm in Dineen's class now.
Well, this is actually the class I'm teaching this semester. I'm trying to show my students the ways in which deeper philosophical worldviews ultimately sort of shape humanity.
Absolutely.
Image, right? But the problem and the challenge in a liberal age is that we think that we're self-making human beings. We don't see the way that we have been shaped by our own order. And so what I try to do, I tell them that we're all like fish swimming in our fish tank, and my purpose is to put a little bit of food color into the water so that it becomes visible to us.
And you were mentioning Chesterton earlier, speaking of fish. One of his, I think this is an orthodox, it's either an orthodoxy or the what's wrong with the world, but it is one paragraph in there where he writes about that the dead float downstream with the current, only the living can swim upstream.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's from orthodoxy.
And it's just, it's just mind-boggling. Did you read that paragraph? It's mind-boggling meditation there. Only the living can swim upstream. And his point in that chapter is that you just go with the flow just to go along, to get along, because other people are doing it and it seems like the thing to do and it's cool. You're dead. That's not living. The living, and he also makes the point, Patrick, in many of his works, that Christianity hasn't been found tried and wanting. It's been found not, what's it? It's been found not tried and difficult, right?
It's been found difficult and therefore not tried.
Difficult and therefore not tried. Now, he's quipping here, but this is largely true. And in reading Chesterton, you know, what you get out of this for your mind, and you said something about philosophical training. You know, this is why I guess I was so... my life changed forever when I discovered Philosophia Perennis and took Brother Francis Maloof's 8-part lecture series, beginning with, I took the course, a college-level course. I took it beginning with logic, to cosmology, to psychology, to ethics, to ancient philosophers, to modern philosophers, to polemics, to epistemology, and then to ontology. And it'll force you especially if you have an open mind and goodwill, it'll make you think, or it'll open your mind up to how you're supposed to think, and how that logic is supposed to be the basis of that thinking. And you can automatically just see I see headlines and I go, that's illogical. Who's the idiot editor that let that headline go out? That headline is wrong. But it helps you to form a more Christian and solid, I think, pursuant to the truth worldview.
Exactly right. What's striking to me listening to you is that what you're describing is exactly the purpose and the end of a liberal arts education, which is not simply to make you refined. It's not simply to allow you to have things to talk about at a cocktail party and drop the names of important authors.
Right.
It's to teach you, not only as you're describing it, how to think, but to think well and to think properly and
right.
think correctly, which is the basis of liberty. It's the basis of freedom. The basis of freedom is to understand, is to have a depth of understanding that allows for one, among other things, to be a self-governing human being. And what's striking to me, and one of the things that I'm actually writing about right now in a book that I'm writing right now called Why Liberalism Failed, which picks up on some of our themes, is that we're seeing the death and demise of liberal arts education in America in favor of an education that basically tells people that to be free is simply to do as one wants, is not to have this kind of training, is no longer to have requirements and courses in philosophy and theology and the kind of the basis for what constitutes the condition of actual liberty.
Right.
So a liberal society reshapes its citizenry to think of liberty in a way that ultimately can't be sustainable. You cannot have a society that can't be self-governing at some level.
And it has to continue, as Brother Andre said last Tuesday, 1 week ago today when he was on the show during this hour, it has to continue to have revolutions. and one revolution is going to overthrow the next. And we saw this with this vulgar, horrid display of this lust for the end of life via abortion on display on the mall in Washington Saturday. Patrick, this was a national disgrace. Absolutely disgraceful that this is what passes for political protest, dissidence, or discourse, or discord, or whatever you wish to call it. No, it was pure, untrammeled lust for the cult of death and vulgarity on display as political speech. And if that's the future of political speech, brother, we are in we may be in bigger trouble than any of us ever previously thought.
Yeah, no, as a display and basically in support of hedonism. And
yes,
hedonism without consequences. Now, of course, you know, and what we're saying is that the consequences are accumulating, and they're accumulating in a form of a people that's ungovernable. And you can't be governed from the center. You can't be governed from some distant power. Governance has to happen within the human soul. And this is the oldest teaching of Plato's Republic and Aristotle's Politics,
sure,
Aquinas and Augustine, that if you're going to be governed, you ultimately have to be governed in your own soul. And to the extent that we are seeing, I think, evidence of a society in which there's a profound inability to be governable, that arises from the illnesses and diseases within the human soul. I think the underlying story of much of what we're seeing taking place today is the self-contradictory logic of an order that was founded,
right,
with an incorrect conception of liberty. And it seems to me what Christians are called to do now is to model, of course, speak about, teach, but also live in ways that demonstrate the alternative and better form of freedom as a form of self-governance and self-rule and self-discipline. What you began by talking about, morality,
right? Right.
What we call morality,
sure,
the ability to distinguish between right and wrong, and to deny that which is wrong and to do that which is right.